speaking today with Mayor Anise Parker. And Mayor Parker, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk to me. So you've been mayor now for almost 2 years. Has it been what you thought it would be when you first decided to run for office?
It's absolutely what I thought it would be, but more so, because you really can't anticipate. And the thing about my election, because it got national and international news, I have a celebrity status quite apart from being mayor of Houston. You know, normally mayors of Houston are not profiled on the front page of the Times of India because of their election. And so I'm having to deal with that attention as the first openly gay or lesbian mayor of a major American city and mayor of the city of Houston. Now, obviously, my first priority is mayor of the city of Houston, but there are good things and bad things about having all of that attention.
Would you classify it as more of a good thing or more of a distraction?
It's actually, sometimes it's a personal distraction, but it's been a good thing for the city of Houston. We have risen on the national map in a number of areas. We're organizations and entities that had never even considered Houston for conventions have rethought that. Organizations that provide grants. The Fast Company magazine named us the City of the Year this year. We have lots of great publicity, and the editor, when he came down, said that the reason they even looked at Houston in the first place was my election, because it so surprised them. ULI coming in and choosing us as one of the cities that they're studying for I've just gone blank. There's some major work that they do where they come in and help cities plan how to redevelop areas and bring interest to bear on that. Again, simply because they were so surprised that the city of Houston would elect me. So my job is to help leverage all of this attention, however it is generated, for the good of the city.
Okay. I think it's fair to say that since you've been elected, it's been an eventful year and a half. There's been a lot going on. Let's talk about some of these things. Let's start with the budget.
Let me say that there's a test of a leader, and you have to be, you're judged on how well you deal with the issues that you know you're going to have to face. And then you're judged on how you deal with the issues that you can prepare for and plan for, but you don't know whether you're going to have to face them or not. And then there's the issues that come at you out of left field. Budget I knew I was going to have problems with. We were in the midst of a recession when I came in, and I knew exactly what the stress points were in the city of Houston and the challenges that we were going to face, and I'm proud of the work that I've been able to do on the budget. I knew I was going to have to trim the city workforce, because that's the biggest cost driver. 3/4 of what we spend is salary and overhead, so I knew I was going to have to deal with that. I knew I was going to have to reform city departments, and we've done consolidations, and we're down 1,500 people. Not all of whom were laid off. About 760 people have been laid off. But those I knew coming in I'd have to fix. That category of you can plan for and prepare for, but you don't know if you're going to have to deal with it, that's the hurricanes or a drought. And we're in the midst of the drought, and it's a struggle. We have 1,000 water mains that are broken across the city of Houston today and have been for weeks. A normal, really, really bad summer day in the city of Houston, we have 200. And so that magnitude of an increase of the problem, fortunately, because we took aggressive action to reform the water sewer system right after I took office, we actually have money to deal with it. We don't have the bodies. But we're coping with that emergency, just as we would cope, I think, successfully with a hurricane or a flood or any other type of natural disaster. Then there's that third category And that would include things like the red light cameras, the curveballs.
We'll get to that later.
Okay. So, I've struggled with those not because, I don't have any trouble making up my mind and moving in a direction and even pushing things that may be unpopular. But the red light camera issue is one of those that damned if you do, damned if you don't. There's no really right way to handle that.
Okay.
And so I would not, I've been asked if I would have changed what I did. No, I wouldn't have changed what I did. But it hasn't been pleasant.
All right, well, you kind of anticipated my future question, so I'll skip that for now. When you look at the budget, I mean, $100 million was cut, 700 and some jobs were eliminated. Do you see this as the new normal, or do you think that when the city's financial picture improves as the economy picks up, do you see, I mean, is it your goal to try and restore some of what was cut?
Absolutely. There are opportunities for efficiencies in the city, and we are aggressively seeking those. It was astounding to me to find out that we had never really made a systematic and aggressive effort to collect monies owed to the city of Houston, and I'm correcting that. But there are places where we've already made permanent changes. We've consolidated HR. We've consolidated payroll. We're in the midst of consolidating our fleet. We're consolidating a lot of our IT functions. And so we are making permanent changes which will allow the city to operate with fewer people. But the biggest cost driver in the budget is the police department. The second biggest cost driver in the budget, the fire department. When you throw in the solid waste department, just from a public safety standpoint, those are hugely important, and they take up much of the money. So it's not as if we can fundamentally change those activities. Solid waste department is the most aggressively privatized department we have. So the money we have there isn't the money we have there, and you can't privatize police or fire protection. The few service cuts that citizens see. We did cut back on library hours, and I would point out that $100 million in cuts this budget, but we've actually trimmed more than $250 million in spending since I came in, because we started right after I took office, so I came in the middle of the fiscal year. The library hours we'd already done, cutting back on pools and community center hours, those are the kind of things I want to restore, but those are relatively small parts of the budget.
Okay. The other big cost driver in all of this is long-term obligations like pension, health insurance, and bond debt. Now, there's only so much you can do about debt, and there's only so much maybe you can do about insurance right now. But, the pension stuff is...
Well, debt is actually being addressed. Of the roughly 63 cents per $100 valuation that people pay, approximately 18 cents of that goes to debt coverage. But because of our reform in the water sewer system, where we overhauled the rate structure, and yes, people's water bills did go up, but we also began to move the water sewer system into a pay-as-you-go posture, slowly. And the with the drainage fee, that is all pay-as-you-go, and that charter amendment also forces our street and drainage program over time to a complete pay-as-you-go system. We can't take out any new debt to do any street or drainage work. So you're gradually going to see the debt burden on the city go down. The only thing that we can debt finance would be what I call the vertical CIP. That would be facilities. So you take a city that already has a really good credit rating. You know, all of our debt is A and double A, and you lower the debt burden on the city. That's all to the good. Health benefits. I also tackled health benefits. We ousted our long-term vendor. It was a very painful political fight, but tens of millions of dollars in cost avoidance and an actual true direct savings to the city, but I still have a health insurance bill of $300 million. I have a $200 million a year pension payment. Pension is the one big thing. So we've addressed debt, we're addressing health benefits. Pension has not been able to make any real substantive difference there.
You're constrained by something.
I'm constrained by state law. I'm constrained by a lack of interest across the state of Texas in really dealing with pension reform, which is somewhat surprising considering what's going on in a lot of other states. And with we've all known that the potential was there for Rick Perry to launch his presidential campaign, so you would think he would maybe have wanted to tackle some of these issues here before doing that. It's right now I have a financial management task force that was created at the request of council that's looking at the long-term fiscal issues facing the city. They're looking at our debt burden. They're looking at, you know, health benefits and pension and payroll. But the pension is unresolved. It's going to take work at the state level, and it's going to take cooperation is not really the word. It's going to take a fundamental paradigm shift for our local pensions in their dealing with the city. I successfully negotiated 3 union contracts this year, all 3 of which have 2 years of pay freezes for our employees, and there are pay raises in the out years because we hope the economy picks up. But as part of that, I also had conversations with the 3 pensions in, you know, balancing the budget and wanting to make, you know, see if there was any flexibility they'd give me so I could move that money and actually pay the people who are doing the work today. And I would say that uniformly the attitude was, well, if you need more money, go out and raise taxes. Not our problem. The police pension did accommodate me to a certain extent in that I actually was able to defer a pension payment, and so we are not completely in balance for budget, but the fire pension was aggressively rude about even the thought. I don't know that it's the current third rail of discussions, political discussions in Houston. I don't think that there is any interest on my part or on the part of any pension reformers in the state of Texas in taking away a pension benefit that someone already has. If you're retired and you're depending on that pension benefit, I cannot imagine a scenario in which your pension benefits would go down. But for those who are active employees, well, and then let me say, I think makes absolute sense for people who are not yet into the municipal workforce or the government workforce across the state, they're going to have a new pension. And then the people who are in the middle who are actively employed right now are the ones that could go either way. But the pensions that I have to deal with, my 3 pensions, are really dug in on that. And the municipal pension negotiated a number of changes with Bill White that were positive for the city of Houston, but they work longer, they pay more money in, and they receive a lesser benefit, and they agreed to that because they were in a severe underfunding position. Bill White took out pension obligation bonds. And we went from a $2 billion underfunding to a $1 billion underfunding. And then when the markets collapsed, we went right back at more than $2 billion, you know, right back worse than we were. Plus, we had $600 million in pension debt added on. So one of the things I'm most proud of is that I balanced my budget without using debt to finance current operations, and a pension payment is a current operation.
Some people are talking about pushing government employees away from defined benefit pensions to a more of a 401k style plan. Do you have any thoughts on that?
It's not a panacea. I could devise a defined contribution plan that was not affordable, and I can devise a defined benefit plan that is affordable. The issue is sitting down and figuring out what works best, but clearly we're putting too much money in pensions today. If I'm looking across my pensions and if nothing changes within 2 years, I'm going to be paying 36% of payroll for my firefighters. That's unsupportable under any circumstances. And so what everybody has to realize, the retirees, you know, the pension representatives with whom I would negotiate if I had the ability to negotiate, taxpayers and the active employees, it's a system. And everybody has to have some skin in the game, and everybody has to see some benefit. And right now, all of the benefits are ending up on the retirees' side. Actually, for a long time, we had regular cost of living increases for our retirees, regular COLAs, and years in which active city employees that are really doing the work today got no pay raises. That's ludicrous, and we have to get there. What if I had, you know, the ability to cast a wish and have it granted? I wouldn't wish for, you know, pensions to be solved. I would wish for the ability to have the solution in my hands so that I could sit with my active unions and my retirees' pensions and negotiate it down here to a final resolution. Problem, as I know you alluded to, I have no ability to negotiate with my firefighters whatsoever. We could agree to anything, and Austin would have to sign off on it. So I don't, there's nothing I can do. The other two, it's permissive negotiations, and if we don't agree, Austin can impose things, but if we don't agree on a change, nothing happens. Just the ability to say, okay, you have to come to the table and we're going to hammer something out and be able to enforce it, that's what I would wish for.
Okay. Since we've talked a lot about police, you know, one of the things that you talked about in your campaign in 2009 was finding ways to get the different police forces that exist, not just in Houston, but in the greater area, to work together. As you said, you know, if you've been robbed, you don't care if it's a Metro cop or an HISD cop, as long as it's someone with a badge and a gun. What progress has been made on that?
Not a whole lot, and that's a frustration. Law enforcement is the most expensive thing that we do. That said, we are coordinating, communicating much more effectively with some of the other law enforcement agencies here. All of the ISDs have police forces. There's the various constables. There's the sheriff's department. And with the leadership of Adrian Garcia over the sheriff's office, we have a much better working relationship. And there are times when I can call Adrian and say, you know, I need some enforcement here. Can you help me? And he responds. I know that my police chief has worked with some of the other chiefs of the smaller agencies to work things out better. We are, because of changes at Metro, coordinating better with Metro. But it's not to the level that it really could be. The biggest impediment is our inability to directly communicate with those other agencies via radio. And we are making a multi-million dollar transition to the same radio frequency as the other agencies here, and that will help that.
Okay.
I haven't given up on that one. Some things that kind of jumped in front of it in terms of regional coordination, the crime lab and jail have
And those things have been in the newspaper, and it seems like, you know, to some degree, the city and the county get along pretty well. I'd say that you and Judge Emmett have a pretty good working relationship.
I have a great working relationship with all members of Commissioner's Court and with Ed Emmett and the other county officials, with the possible exception of Steve Raddick. And
Once again, you've anticipated my question.
But Steve Raddick, when it suits him, has worked well with me on some things. We have been working to provide some solutions to maintenance needs in Cullen Park. He and I share an interest in animal welfare. He and I share an interest in stopping the proliferation of fireworks, in developed areas of the state. And I try to work with him in those areas where we can work productively. And I do my best not to say insulting things about him in public, which I would really appreciate if he would extend the courtesy back. But we have worked together.
All right. Do you see any... Is there anything on the horizon for the city and county to be working together on something or working better together on something that's not the case now?
We work very, very well in terms of flooding and drainage with Harris County. Mike Talbot and Art Story, their infrastructure guy over there, both great guys and true professionals. And we coordinate very well. We are actually, despite what you may have read in the paper, moving toward a regional crime lab with the county as the primary. We're trying to push more of our crime lab, at least the DNA work right now, over to the county. I want to get out of the crime lab business. The county has a first-class crime lab. However, the county's focus is on DNA, and we have a number of other forensic areas that we want them to take. The only real impediment is the capacity, so we're going to have to phase in moving the work over to the county. And the fact that having a regional crime lab that the county runs is not that much better than having a regional crime lab that the city runs, in the sense that it's not truly independent. And what I want to see is, it can be a county crime lab, but I'd like to see a governing board of objective, independent, professionals.
Something that's not aligned with the prosecution.
Something that's not in any way aligned with the prosecution, to have oversight on how the lab is operated. And then you have an independent regional lab.
Okay.
But we're moving on the jail as well. We work together very well in coming together around the Dynamo Stadium,
mm-hmm.
pushing that forward. We do a lot of the libraries and the parks systems work cooperatively regularly. We have several libraries where one or the other has the facility, and then the other entity does the operations side. Same with parks. So,
okay,
good things happen.
One of the issues that you took on over the first term was historic preservation. And again, I think it's fair to say that has generated some strong feelings on both sides of the issue. There are people who believe very passionately one way or the other. I mean, look back on that. Is there anything you'd do differently? And where do you go from here on that?
I want to thank Councilmember Lovell for taking point on that and doing a lot of the heavy lifting. What I might have done differently on that is get involved earlier on personally. I think there were times where citizens could have been brought along better, things could have been explained better, and it might have been able to be handled without so many hurt feelings. But when it comes right down to it, what we had wasn't working, and the people who are unhappy with current ordinance, there's not an ordinance that they would have been happy with. That they believe that preservation is an infringement on their property rights, and they're very vocal, but there is not any type of ordinance. However we had passed it, however we had worked it through council, that they would have been happy with.
One of the things that I know people have complained about is the way the votes were counted for determining whether a given subdivision or neighborhood or whatever was declared to be historic, and that was basically, if you didn't vote, it was counted as a yes vote for preservation. And that's not how elections are generally done, is it?
Well, actually, it is basically how I'm elected and how most council members are elected. If people don't vote, they're not counted. It wasn't necessarily that we counted people who didn't vote as a yes vote. We only focused on the people who chose to cast a ballot. We had a different situation with, we had existing historic districts, we had historic districts that hadn't been generated yet, and then we had three historic districts that were in progress when we started things. And most of the historic districts that were already designated when we started did not go through the opt-out process at all. So the majority of the historic districts went through smoothly and easily and you know, not really any controversy. All of the angst and real heartburn, it was the Heights and Glenbrook Valley. I got some criticism on, they were picking apart things like, well, the ordinance says that we'll send out a letter or a postcard. We send out a letter instead of a postcard. In terms of a legal document, it's the same thing. That really wasn't, I mean, we thought a letter would be more formal, more noticeable. The idea of only the no votes, we actually did that to try to make it easier for people to vote no. That, you know, it's not a matter of, we didn't have to count votes, we didn't have to go out and do a big information campaign. It's like, if you want out of the historic district, just vote no and send us back. Nothing could be easier. We saw that as a way to streamline the process and make it extra easy for the anti-preservationists to weigh in. But no good deed goes unpunished.
Okay. It seems like every few years there is some sort of flare-up in a given neighborhood over some type of development that people don't want. We had the Ashby High-Rise. We now have the A-line to Walmart.
That's true.
There's litigation going on, and Lord only knows what will happen there. You know, let's talk generally for a second. It seems like, you know, what all of these things boil down to is the residents of a given neighborhood don't have the tools that they would like to have to exert control over development in their neighborhood.
We live in an unzoned city, and we have voted on zoning over and over again. Citizens of Houston have chosen not to do that. We're not going to get zoning. In absent zoning, you can have some narrowly crafted ordinances that help you control development. As a council member, I championed the minimum lot size. It was called the prevailing lot size and prevailing building line, but now minimum lot size, minimum building line. Those were my babies, and I helped draft them in order to give neighborhoods extra tools to help keep out unwanted development. There's historic preservation. The historic preservation ordinance is another tool to preserve neighborhood character and keep out unwanted development. But all those three different ordinances are narrowly tailored to solve specific problems because we're not going to be able to do zoning. Now, I have a draft density and development ordinance that may be coming to council, and it will be controversial because whatever we do will limit the ability of high-rise development in certain areas. You could call it the Ashby High-Rise Memorial Ordinance if you want to, because that's really what's driving this. I don't know what the final version is going to look like, but it won't make either side happy because it will impose some limits on development, and it won't be a blanket denial of the ability to put, you know, a high rise next to a residential property. There are, you know, say the Ashby high rise. If we say that those kind of dense high rise structures belong on major thoroughfares, and I believe they do, take that building, move it a short distance east or west, and you're either on Main Street or you're on Kirby. It's a perfectly appropriate place to be, but it's still going to abut residential property, single-family homes, and the neighbors are going to hate it. The difference with the Ashby high-rise is that it was in the middle of a residential neighborhood.
And so there were that many more neighbors to hate it.
There were many more neighbors to hate it, but I cannot draw an ordinance. I cannot draw an ordinance that keeps a high-rise development from abutting residential property, because we're never going to have the tools in our unzoned city to do that. And I actually think that one of the reasons, you know, and I used to be a big zoning proponent, and it would still make it easier. Sometimes governing the city of Houston without zoning is messy, and it would make it easier to do that. But I have become convinced that part of the reason that our property taxes are, well, not property taxes, that our property values hold up, and that our cost of housing is so affordable here in Houston, our cost of living is so affordable here in Houston, is that you have the ability to quickly redevelop neighborhoods, that you have the potential of getting the highest and best value out of your piece of property.
Yeah. If we've seen anything in the recent census, it's that people, you know, the areas that get more people into them tend to do better politically. Now, let's talk specifically about the Walmart for a second. The use of the 380 agreement remains controversial.
That one does. We've done other 380 agreements that have been non-controversial.
And I think in this case, it's because, well, one, of course, a lot of people, not everybody, did not want a Walmart at that location.
People were excited. People were excited about a new development and the opportunities when it was an HEB. You cannot tell me that an HEB on that site has any more problems with lighting or noise or traffic than a Walmart. I heard a lot of very unfortunate things about those kind of people who shop at Walmart, but from a city standpoint, if the neighbors were excited about having an HEB, what's the difference with a Walmart? Because we started working on a 380 agreement with Ainbinder when they did not yet have an anchor tenant. They just knew that they wanted primarily a grocery store type tenant.
Tell me what the city is going to get out of the 380 agreement and the money that it's going to help Ainbinder get to do stuff.
There's been a lot of misinformation about 380 agreements, and the city's giving $6 million to Walmart. We're not giving anybody anything. The reason that I have chosen 380 agreements instead of traditional tax abatements is the 380 agreement requires the company that wants something, wants to expand, wants to open a business, to spend their money on public infrastructure. The development is spending $6 million to upgrade drainage, to put in sidewalks, to improve the median. They're doing work in the public space on their dollar. And we allow them to recoup their payment out of the taxes that they would generate. There's no upfront payment from the city at all. They have to spend their money to create the public infrastructure, and if they don't generate any tax dollars, say the company goes belly up. And no, let's not talk about Walmart, because that's not going to happen, but we've done other 380 agreements. The Oak Farms Dairy, Lovett Homes has a couple of 380 agreements. If the company were to make this agreement, they put the infrastructure in, and then they go belly up, I don't have to pay them back at all. It allows me to use their money for something that I need in the city anyway.
Okay. When you filed for re-election, one of the things you said was that, you know, you spent a lot of this term reacting to things, and that for your next term, you would like to be more proactive. You would like to do stuff that's on your own agenda. What is your agenda for the next 2 years?
Well, I actually got to do some things on my agenda. I really did come in with the idea of true fiscal reform. So we are we're working on collecting money owed to the city of Houston. The consolidations of city departments where we're running leaner and meaner and more efficiently, those are my initiatives. The overhaul of the water sewer system and the emphasis on infrastructure, that's my passion and that's my initiative. But you know, the recession meant that I had to stop a lot of things from happening. The recession meant that we're down 1,500 employees. Well, half of those were because we found efficiencies and we didn't need those people. But half of those, like 760 people, were issued pink slips for budgetary reasons. And so, you know, I want to restore some of those cuts and those service cuts. Then I want to work on improving city processes. We're known as a business-friendly city, but we can be better at that. We're a great city in terms of supporting outdoor activities, but we can be better at that. I want to make sure that we take our hike and bike trails and string the beads. But you ought to be able to go anywhere in the city of Houston on a bike trail, particularly separated off-road bike trail along every one of our bios. I want to be able to connect the major parks. Within the next 2 years, you're going to see a lot of that accomplished because it's in the works already. I want to begin to see the results of the street and drainage program, Rebuild Houston, that we have begun to implement, where for the first time we deal holistically with drainage problems in the city of Houston. And instead of being, again, reactive, where, okay, this area flooded, we're going to go pretend we're doing something, we actually look at the city on a watershed basis and say, okay, we want to solve a drainage problem here, but that means we have to spend money there, and we're going to go spend money there, and we're going to tell the public this is why we're spending it over there, and we're not just going to spread the capital dollars across the city like peanut butter on bread. We're going to spend the capital dollars where scientifically it makes sense to do that. And so begin to really reform the CIP process in the city of Houston. These are all things that I'm excited about working on. And I will say that we've also been an innovator in sustainability here in the city, that we are absolutely on the national map in terms of being a city with interest in renewable energy. We're the largest municipal purchaser of green and renewable energy. We just had a press conference today about the city's purchase of electric vehicles and leveraging a lot of private sector investment in electric vehicle charging stations across the city. And so those kind of things, continuing the initiatives that we've begun on sustainability, showing that in the heart of the oil and gas capital of America, that we recognize that while oil and gas is not going away, that there is a different energy future out there as well, and that Houston still has the chops to set the world standard.
And just to sum up, why should people vote to give you that second term and implement that agenda when they go to vote in November?
The most important thing a mayor can do is to lead an effective and efficient workforce to provide the services that the city needs. And whatever anybody may think about things like red light cameras or historic preservation and the other things that we've mentioned, take a look at this city. We are a great city. We operate at a very high level, day in and day out. And we have a first-class workforce that is getting better. We remain a city that gets things done and that is well-led and well-managed. I've shown what I've been able to do under extremely trying circumstances over the last 18 months, and I'm asking for the opportunity to continue to improve this city in what I hope will be a better economic climate.
Mayor Anise Parker, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Absolutely.